May it please the Court, I'm Robert Jobe, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the petitioner Sunil Prakash. This case presents a single discrete issue, whether the offense of soliciting another person to commit a crime of violence is itself a crime of violence under 18 U.S.C. Section 16b. Under 18 U.S.C. 16b, a crime of violence includes any offense that is a felony and which by its nature involves a substantial risk that physical force may be used against a person or property in the course of committing the offense. Now, Mr. Prakash was convicted of soliciting another individual to assault and rape his wife. Under People v. Wilson, this is a case cited in the government's brief at page 17. The California Supreme Court sets forth the definition of solicitation and when that crime is complete. It says, solicitation is defined as an offer or invitation to another to commit the crime with the intent that the crime be committed. Importantly, the Supreme Court of California goes on to say, the crime of solicitation is complete once the verbal request is made with the requisite criminal intent. So the issue in this case, really, is whether there's a substantial risk that physical force may be used in the course of committing this offense, that is, in the course of making a verbal invitation to another person to commit a crime. And the answer to that is simply no. I don't think you need to go any further, because under the plain language of the statute, there has to be a substantial risk that force will be used or may be used in the course of committing the crime, in the course of committing the offense. And here, the offense is nothing more than inviting another person to commit a criminal act. A horrible criminal act, it's true. And it's a crime of violence. The criminal act is being solicited. The solicitation itself is not the type of conduct that inherently involves a substantial risk of force being used in the course of committing that crime.
We have a Third Circuit case, don't we? It's very, very similar that doesn't see it your way.
Yeah, that case, let's pull that up. That case, I found it interesting. That case was decided after and yet it makes absolutely no citation to Leocal. It doesn't grapple at all with holding of Leocal. And in Leocal, the Supreme Court made clear that in determining whether an offense is a crime of violence under Section 16b, you need to focus on whether there's a substantial risk that force may be used in the course of committing the offense.
Well, I'm not sure that Leocal really emphasize the course of committing the offense as in, okay, you've committed a criminal offense, we're going to close our eyes to the future implications of that.
Actually, Your Honor, I beg to differ. I mean, what it said is, for example, in footnote 7 of the decision, because they're dealing with drunk driving there. In Leocal, the Supreme Court said, the risk that an accident may occur when an individual drives while intoxicated is simply not the same thing as the risk that the individual may use physical force against another in committing a DUI offense. It's focused, the decision is focused on, is there a substantial risk that force, physical force may be used in the course of committing the crime? The 28J letter that we submitted, unfortunately, was late yesterday.
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot of difficulty saying the crime that your client was convicted of is one that entails that risk.
In the course of committing the crime?
See, that's emphasizing something different.
Right.
You're trying to say, look, he committed his crime before the force was applied, so that force shouldn't be counted against him. I think that's a different question. I don't think Leocal offers you much support for that proposition.
I beg to differ. But if you look at the case that we submitted yesterday, the Sixth Circuit decision in Hull,
it hasn't come up to me yet, involves
possession of a pipe bomb, and holding that was not a crime of violence. The Sixth Circuit emphasized that in Leocal, the Supreme Court emphasized that under 16b, the test is whether or not there's a substantial risk that physical force will be used in the commission of the offense. Everybody agrees that possessing a pipe bomb can be very dangerous to another person, but it's not the kind of offense that involves physical force in the commission of the crime itself.
Counsel, how do you deal with our case of United States versus Cox, which involves solicitation for a murder? That was clearly held to be a crime of violence. What's the difference between a solicitation for a murder versus a solicitation for a rape, in the sense of it being a crime of violence?
That, Your Honor, Cox involved an altogether different statute and a different statutory test. There, a crime of violence was defined as a crime which involves conduct that presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to another. Obviously, soliciting somebody to kill your wife or rape your wife, that involves or presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to another. And for purposes of Cox, that was enough to make it a crime of violence. But here, the issue is not whether it presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to another, but rather whether there's a substantial risk that force may be used in the course of committing the offense.
But counsel, when you look at 18 U.S.C. Section 16, subpart B, it does specifically state that it involves a substantial risk that physical force against the person or property of another.
Right, but it doesn't end there.
No, may be used in the course of committing the offense.
Right.
And you think that we just close our eyes to what he was soliciting. Because you say that under the state's ruling in Wilson, once he makes a solicitation, whether it even occurs, the crime is done, and that's it.
I'm suggesting, Your Honor, that you have to give effect to the plain language of the statute. You can't ignore the last five words of Section 16. Mm-hmm. Section 16b, unlike the sentencing guidelines, specifically limits the inquiry to is there a risk that physical force may be used in the course of committing the crime?
Is there any either logic or legislative history that supports the notion that you close your eyes to what happens later? I mean, I doubt that those words were stuck in to cut things off. I think they were stuck in to extend the time period you consider. In this context, because of the nature of solicitation, it may arguably cut things off. But is there any logic behind that?
I haven't seen any legislative history behind it, Your Honor, but obviously you have to give effect to the plain language of the statute. And obviously there's a dramatic difference between the language and the sentencing guidelines, which define a crime of violence and language here. You have to give effect to that difference in language, and that difference in language limits the inquiry of this particular situation to whether there's a substantial risk of force being used in the course of committing the offense. And because the offense here is nothing more than a verbal invitation, there's no way that you can conclude that there's a substantial risk that force may be used in the course of committing this kind of crime. We all agree that the crime that's being solicited here is ugly. You know, it's ugly. But that's not the question. The question legally presented here is, does this crime fit within the framework of Section 16B? And unfortunately, the board tried to shoehorn this offense into that definition, and it just doesn't fit. And for that reason, I think you have to overturn the board's decision here and send this back. The board didn't address whether these offenses might constitute crime of violence in 16A. And that's not an issue before the court. So if you reverse on 16B and the case goes back, the board's going to have to grapple with that question, and also whether this is an aggravated felony under Section 101A43U of the INA.
Thank you, Mr. Joe. Good morning.
Good morning. May I please report? My name is Jesse Blesser, representing the Attorney General of the United States. I'm going to start off. I applaud Mr. Joe for referencing California state law because it is important that we look there and we look there first. And what he left out there was the intent that is required. You need to have the intent to commit the underlying offense. In California, it is only violent felonies that are prescribed under the solicitation statute. And that is the difference in this case. That is what makes it a crime of violence. Because you cannot be convicted for this crime unless you have the present intent to commit the offense. And that creates a risk of physical force will be used against the victim or the intended victim. And so
you have to have the present intent that force be used against the victim?
Well, in this case, for example, it was rape by force.
Right.
So you have to have the present intent to commit rape by force. So that obviously entails that force will be used against the intended victim.
Well, the argument petitioner offers acknowledges that force is down the road, but says that, look, the solicitation offense is done at the time the verbal solicitation is accomplished, and so the force itself doesn't take place when his offense, solicitation, is committed.
Right. And then, that argument is one that the board dealt with. And trying to explain that for you, let me just say that it is the intent that is really the critical factor. It's not that something may or may not happen. It's just like in the burglary context, if someone has walked into a home, maybe someone's home, maybe someone's not. Maybe physical force will be used, maybe it will not. It's that if someone has the intent to commit such a violent felony, and they want to, and they take a step, whether it be an invitation or whether they walk through the door, is there a present risk that the physical force is going to be used? And the attorney general's position is that it is. And much like the Third Circuit found, if you go and you take steps and you intend that someone's going to come to across state lines to murder your wife, and you want it to happen, that's the desire of yourself, does that create a substantial risk that physical force is going to be used? No problem saying it did. And much like, you know, I understand Cox's and 17 guidelines, but I think what the court really focused on, and simply stated, was if you have the present intent to have someone murder your wife, is your wife in harm's way? And that's the Attorney General's position in this case, is that, yeah, there's really no difference.
Well, I'm, and frankly, I don't know that the petitioner really contests the proposition, but I think we still have the same problem. And this is unusual for an immigration case. Usually in an immigration case, the unfairness, the sense of unfairness falls on the side of the petitioner, but the statute winds up saying what it says. Well, in this case, I mean, all the logic, as best I can see, runs in favor of the government's position. The question becomes, does the wording of the statute thwart the government's position and the sense of fairness here, because the statute makes reference to, excuse me, the use of physical force in the course of committing the offense, and the problem becomes, what's the offense? If the offense is only solicitation, well, there's actually no force itself exerted during the solicitation. It may be that everybody knows the next day somebody's in big trouble, but is that wording something that thwarts the effort to apply what should be the logic of the statute?
Right. And I understand that fortunately, not an uncommon experience when you're dealing with the INA, is that the wording of the statute somehow leads you, or somehow is excluded from that logic. But I think when you look at the Third Circuit case, I think when you look at Leocal as well, Leocal was more of a mens rea problem. Because there, you know, the person was driving under the influence without really a mens rea to cause any harm. I think a lot of the wording in the statute is directed towards focusing the government's position on if you're going to charge someone with committing a nonviolence, they have to intend that harm occurs, and intend that violence occurs. And this,
you know, counsel, I'm puzzled by that in light of the Wilson case. That seems to make it clear that under California law, the solicitation itself is all we're talking about. So that if the petitioner solicits the rape of his wife, never does anything more about it, never makes the payment or whatever was going to be required to get this to occur, he is still guilty of solicitation of rape, and yet no violence occurred because he didn't make the payment or whatever the case may be. Doesn't the petitioner have some basis in stating that under California law that it's a real stretch to get this to be a crime of violence?
Well, if you only focus on the invitation without looking at the intent, and again,
you talk about the intent, but that's not what Wilson says.
Well, I think Wilson makes clear that from California, it's established solicitation. For one, is to cut it off to only the most egregious one.
I understand that.
And two, they make sure that if you're going to punish someone, the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant had a present intent to commit the underlying offense. And again, if the crime was, if we could somehow punish all people who have a present intent to kill their wife, would that create a substantial risk that force would be used? I would certainly, the Attorney General's position is that it would.
Well, California is really speaking to something, I mean, a different problem. The question is, when has there been a criminal act for California law purposes? And frankly, we understand the logic of the California Supreme Court in saying, look, you don't have to have the actual violence to commit solicitation. So when they say complete, they're not talking about the door being closed. They're really talking about, look, this is enough to constitute a criminal act. They're facing a different direction. So they're not trying to answer the question that we're trying to answer here. And the question really becomes, okay, when you've accomplished the solicitation or any crime, burglary, whatever it is, when you've done enough to become criminally liable, when does the door close for the acts you consider linked sufficiently? And so I'm not, I mean, the California decision is important, but it's from a different direction from my sense. Do we have anything that we can look to that helps us with the problem we have here, which is how far down the road should you consider the ripples on the pond in terms of what the effect is, given that the language of the statute here does include some language we have to take into account?
No, we really don't, and Third Circuit really don't address the issue. And but in looking towards, and again, I know you want guidance from the federal legislation, there doesn't appear to be any, but if you look at the why California chose to do what it did, it's because these crimes, when you have the intent and you go and solicit others to join you, it's because it creates the present risk that, you know what, if we don't prescribe this conduct, harm will occur. And it could occur. Because I keep bringing me back and focusing on this because I think it is critical. And it's the most important fact that California, it's not just you make them addicted. You have to want to commit the underlying offense. And that present desire creates a risk that force is going to may be used. And then again, that's the language you said, may be used against the intended victim. And the government's position is that constitutes crime law.
What role, if any, does our Barragan-Lopez case play in the analysis that we must do in this case?
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. Is that a recent decision?
2007.
And it's Lopez.
It's Barragan-Lopez versus Mukasey, 508 Fed 3rd, 899. In that case, we held that an alien's conviction for solicitation to possess at least 4 pounds of marijuana constituted a crime of moral turpitude. Now, that's not a crime of violence, but it's the same reasoning that we're dealing with in this case.
I think here, of course, there's a distinction between looking at whether solicitation is covered in the Controlled Substance Act, but certainly, I can tell what the reasoning was in terms of craved conduct. And morally, gratuitous or whatever, or what you might have. And here, certainly that conduct would constitute that. I don't know if it has any impact other than drawing on what is plainly a depraved act. Anytime you intend to commit such a heinous crime as one that was intended to be based, certainly it would be constitute crime of moral turpitude. I think, though, it would not be correct for me to have this court look to the crime involving moral turpitude context, because again, the board and the agency in this case did focus on whether it was a crime of violence. And so I would stress in this court to look just simply to there. However, the intent behind it, looking at whether this present intent, the only guidance you can call is whether this present intent somehow was more than a traitor. I don't think there would be much trouble in this case, so I would simply ask the court to focus on whether it was unbonded from 16 days.
Thank you, Mr. Bless.
Thank you.
Mr. Job, you get the last word.
Very briefly, going back to this Third Circuit case, the holding in this case, it basically summarizes the position in two different places before the end of the decision. It says, employing a categorical approach here, we are satisfied that the use of interstate commerce facilities in the commission of a murder for hire poses a substantial risk that physical force will be used against another. That's true. Undoubtedly, that's true. But it's not enough. Because here, the issue isn't simply whether or not there's a substantial risk that physical force will be used against another. The question is, is there a substantial risk that physical force will be used in the course of committing a crime?
Let me ask you this. Suppose we can interpret the statute the way you urge us to, but we can also interpret it the way the government does and the way the Third Circuit does. Don't we, in that situation, have to defer to the agency?
No, not in this case. This court has held repeatedly that it doesn't defer to the board's interpretation of 18 U.S.C. Section 16. The case Ortega-Mendez versus Gonzalez is 453F3-1010. That's because it's not just an immigration statute. It's incorporated into the INA, but it's criminal.
Thank you.
So there's no deference to criminal. There are no other questions.
I guess. Thank you, Mr. Joe. Mr. Bless, thank you as well. The case just argued is submitted.